So I'd like us to welcome Comrade Garuba Benuahai.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Peace and freedom to all of the freedom fighters. I want to say that Alhaj Malik Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X, has once said that history is the best subject to reward all research. And the purpose that we should research history is to help us not commit the errors of the past and to capitalize on the weaknesses of our enemy who continues to commit the errors of the past. But first of all, I want to say that I only have a few minutes and we're going to get into it. First of all, I want to say that I only have a few minutes and we're going to get into a discussion. And one of the reasons that I feel it very important to participate in this aspect of this conference is because, as Ahmed pointed out, the conference has been essentially an intellectual endeavor on many levels. But it is also an opportunity to expose young black brothers and sisters to the history of our struggle, to a principled analysis of where we need to be going, and to help them make decisions about what type of organizations they would like to commit to the history of our struggle, to a principled analysis of where we need to be going, and to help them make decisions about what type of organizations they would like to commit themselves to, what type of philosophy they would begin to develop in their personal lives. But most important, I think, and transcending all of these particulars, is the issue of moral and ethical commitment. You must develop an ethical and moral commitment to the liberation of your people, or you will have no movement. One of the most crucial issues to the development of our movement at this particular stage in our history, one of the pivotal issues, is the issue of political prisons.
That's right.
And why is that the case? How could I make such a definite statement? Let us examine history. When the first black person was brought to this country as a tool or an instrument of development, a tool of production, as a chattel slave, what was being imported into this country was a serious contradiction. That contradiction has grown over the centuries until America, the United States, is confronted with the contradiction of 30 million people of African descent with nothing for them to do. We are no longer tools of production. We no longer serve an economic function. So what is to become of us? And I'm skipping over a lot of history. I trust that most of you have enrolled in your black studies courses. And so I can skip from the Pilgrims and segue to 1990. What will become of us? What is happening to us as a people is that the United States ruling elite has decided to re-enslave us under a new system of slavery. The means by which they are attempting to do this is the criminalization of our movements, the criminalization of poverty, the criminalization of class, the criminalization of race, and the criminalization of gender. Through the criminalization of poverty, the United States government is attempting to make it a crime to be poor in this country. They are passing legislation that is aimed at making poor people the brunt of all of the problems of this country. They are passing legislation that makes it increasingly difficult for poor people to get housing, for poor people to get a relevant education, for poor people to earn a living. In fact, white folks are filing discrimination suits today, claiming reverse discrimination. on the other level, a level that has plagued us ever since our introduction in this country, and do not be mistaken, we were brought to this country as an economic tool of production, but also our skin pigmentation lent itself to our chattel slavery, because one of the primary purposes that the Europeans saw, one of the primary justifications that the Europeans used to enslave us was our skin color. Because we could not flee in a Eurocentric society. We could not hide in a Eurocentric society. And they never believed that the system of slavery would ever be abolished. So racism has become the raison d'etre, the reason for, the justification for many economic exploitations that we are subjected to. Okay? So race, the criminalization of people of color, rendering people of color as, or portraying people of color as essentially criminals, as the police would say, potential perpetrators of a crime. As portraying people of color as potential criminals, we are all targeted and we are all pointed at as potential flesh or commodities for the criminal justice system. One of the fastest growing industries in the country is the criminal justice system, specifically expansion of prisons. We also hear former Chief Justice Burger talking about the privatization of prisons, making prisons into industrial camps. We see that the war on drugs is a smokescreen for the militarization of the police, the total abandonment of certain constitutional rights, and the complete occupation of the black community. This all has its roots in the repression of the first African to enter this country. In the 1960s, and I would like to point out, as Brother Muhammad Ahmed very succinctly pointed out, in the 1960s, we were subjected to a brutal repression by the U.S. government, by every agency of the U.S. government, by every police force in the United States. But this repression, some of its techniques, had its genesis, had its birth in the repression of Africans on the plantation. Many of the techniques had their birth there. For instance, when the counterintelligence program went after Malcolm X, Alhaj Malik Shabazz, or it went after a prominent militant black spokesman, it was a continuation of the old psychological ploy of repression that the slave master would institute on the plantation. He would take the most rebellious field nigger. He would flay him to within an inch of his life, until the skin hung off of his flesh, off of his bones, and hang him in a tobacco barn so that every slave could walk by and see what happens to the rebellious black man. He served as the example so that you would not rebel, so that you would not flee. Well, they did the same thing with Alhaj Malik Shabazz. They slayed him, and they slayed him in such a public and heinous way. They slayed them in such a despicable fashion. And they did it for one reason and one reason only, to discourage the development of any black revolutionaries in this country. When our youth resurrect Alhaj Malik Shabazz and they say that he is their hero, they are resurrecting a frame of mind. A mindset. But we have to be careful, because it is much easier to support dead heroes than to support live ones. The counterintelligence program that was implemented in the 1960s had its roots on the slave plantation, and the modern manifestation of it had its roots in the destruction of the Universal Negro Improvement Association of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. And as Brother Muhammad Ahmed pointed out, and Sister Joan Gibbs aptly pointed out, that was the largest organization of African people in America that has ever graced this country. But Marcus Garvey was driven into exile. He was falsely convicted on trumped up tax evasion charges. His organization was infiltrated. Its leadership was decimated. And the organization and the movement was destroyed. It took us almost 30 years to regroup in terms of developing a militant mass movement and struggle. And what happened then? The government, after using COINTELPRO and its counterintelligence agencies against the Communist Party, viewing the Communist Party as an internal threat to its security, after using certain techniques against them in the middle 50s in the McCarthy era, focused all of its attention primarily upon the Black Liberation Movement. And it carried out certain types of operations that were aimed at the Black Liberation Movement. It was aimed, some of the earliest documents that I read that was aimed at the Black Nationalist Movement were aimed at RAND, the Revolutionary Action Movement. It was aimed at other organizations in the Black community that advocated not just separation, but advocated that Black people arm themselves and develop an armed component to their liberation movement. This is very important to understand. Because the United States, like most modern nation states, and we should get into this later on, what is the nature of the modern state? The United States, like most governments, understands one thing. That there can be no legitimate thrust for political empowerment without the capacity for organized violence. The United States does not understand anything except violence. It's the language they speak best. You cannot go to the negotiating table attempting to negotiate for your freedom and you are not also fighting on the battlefield. Check out history. The United States did not go to the negotiating table in Korea because the North Koreans were nonviolent. They were forced to the negotiation table. The United States did not negotiate in Paris in terms of Vietnam in the Vietnam era. They were forced to the negotiation table with body bags coming home in droves. So understand something, that violence can be proactive or reactive. It can be negative or it can be positive. When the oppressed people rise up against their oppressor to resist the violence of their oppression, that is proactive violence. That is positive violence. When the oppressor tries to maintain his privilege and exploitation of an oppressed people through the force of arms and violence, that is reactionary violence. We need to make a distinction. There is a moral distinction to be made here. There is an ethical distinction to be made here. Those who would say that the issue is a question of violence per se are, of course, missing the boat. We have to organize ourselves on a multiplicity of levels, on many levels. But we cannot neglect one level to the exclusion of the other. We cannot just talk. We cannot just sing. We have to swing. And we got to walk that walk. The enemy understood this. So in the 1960s, in 1968, fully 85% of the operations that were aimed at the Black Liberation Movement, the counterintelligence operations, were aimed at the Black Panther Party and organizations that advocated the armed self-defense of the Black community from racist attack. 85% of every counterintelligence operation aimed at the New Left and the Black movement in this country were aimed at the Black Panther Party in particular and those organizations on the left of the Black movement who advocated armed self-defense. It's very important to understand. On the other hand, the enemy being very astute in the tactics of divide and conquer, understood that if you use the stick you must also employ the carrot. And the carrot that they employed was the opening up of the democratic process to the Jesse Jacksons, to the black elected officials. The carrot that they used were the development of black leadership programs. In fact, many of you would not be in college today were it not for the guns of the Black Panther Party. And it's interesting to note that yesterday, the other day, I was watching on television the Phil Donahue show, and he had Bobby Seale and David Hilliard and Imam Jamil Alameen and Fred Hampton's widow and someone else on the television. And it was Phil Donahue who was articulating the rage of the black community. Check it out. Phil Donahue said, "How could y'all sit there so calmly when the black community is on, they're under siege, they're under attack? I mean, how could you do that? I don't see no anger, no fire." I know, I was supposed to be there, but they canceled out at the last minute. So what y'all should do, y'all should write Phil Donahue and say, "Hey, yo, Holmes, what's up with this?" But that's an aside, that's a joke. My point is we have come full circle to where the white media is articulating the rage of the black community. That's deep. And black leaders are incapable of articulating that rage. They are out of touch with the rage of our community. And the reason why they're out of touch with that rage is because we have somehow believed that it's no longer fashionable, it's no longer cool to get angry at being oppressed. One of the things they used to say, one of the things they used to say about Muhammad Ahmed back in the 60s was that the brother was crazy. This is what they said in the documentary. They said the brother was crazy, hated all white folks. Now I said, well, that's an oversimplification, right? They said that about all of us. We was crazy, we hated all white folks, which of course was not the case. This gave the impression that we had no analysis. This gave the impression that we just hated people based on the color of their skin. You see? Understand this. It's very important to understand that in order for repression to go down, the enemy must have a moral and ethical claim to repress us. This is what made the repression of the Dr. Martin Luther King so difficult. Because they had attack dogs going after him. They had brutal racist police clubbing black women and children, all because they wanted to integrate a lunch counter or ride on the bus. They had no moral basis for this. This made the United States look terrible abroad. So they had to change their tactics. They had to make like they were the good guys and we were the bad guys. And the way they did that is that they began to criminalize our movements. They criminalized our movements and they said it was just a question of law enforcement. It was just a question of law and order. Today, they are doing the same thing. Instead of using the word law and order, they are using the words war on drugs. They are gaining moral credibility. They are gaining moral credibility by being against drugs. We need to understand this and be very clear about this. Because drugs is a pernicious problem in our community, but it was the CIA and the government that introduced drugs in our community in the first place. If they want to do some SWAT team tactics, why don't they bum rush Bush? Yeah. They won't do this. They won't do this because there's another program behind that. And the counterintelligence program in the 60s went after the organizations that represented the ability or the capacity of the black community to defend the integrity of the black community. To defend the moral integrity, the political integrity, the economic integrity of the black community. So, the counterintelligence program was a very shrewd program. It went after the militants, quote, and it supported the liberals or the integrationists. When the counterintelligence program reached its zenith in 1970-69, It had decimated the Black Panther Party and other organizations. We had to spend fully 80% of our time struggling to free the brothers and sisters in prison. But this is to be expected in regards to an effective movement. You expect to be repressed. So the Black Panther Party had organized an underground as well. There were brothers and sisters in the Black Panther Party who never attended a rally or never walked into the Black Panther Party office. But the enemy knew that too, and their objective was to drive us underground or to destroy us. But to destroy us, they had to first destroy the idea of the Black Panther Party in the minds of black people. So they criminalized us, and they used our own weaknesses against us. What was our major weakness? One of our major weaknesses was sexism. One of our major weaknesses was our inability to separate our moral values from the morality of the enemy. Very important. And this is one reason why I admire our comrades in the Puerto Rican movement the way I do. Because they have made it a criteria for involvement in their struggle, that one does not participate in the use of drugs, that they do not get involved in amoral sexual behavior. They treat their women with respect, and the women are accorded leadership positions in their organizations. We have to understand that if we are to defeat our enemy, we have to defeat them first and foremost morally and ethically. Then when our enemy comes after us with their little old jive programs, the whispering in one ear and talking about, hey, what did the leader do with the money? Hey, so-and-so is backstreeting with your wife. We don't even have to deal with that. We could just move on to something else. It's very important. So the counterintelligence program became successful in this respect because we had certain weaknesses. Some of them Muhammad touched on, ideological differences. Okay? But once the counterintelligence program was successful in destroying or dividing the black movement's militant wing, it then developed into something else. It developed into a program called NUKIL, which we'll discuss later. NUKIL was a counterinsurgency program. It took up where COINTELPRO left off. It was aimed at the black underground because those brothers and sisters who could no longer function above ground went underground. And how would they get them? They hooked up a counterinsurgency program, an anti-urban guerrilla program. And they had organized teams of Barsi agents, or Bureau of Special Service agents, federal agents. And they developed this into what became known as the Joint Terrorist Task Force. Out of this repression, what the police call this in their training program, the first and second BLA wars. They divide the period from 70 to 72 and from 72 to 74, and they call it the first and second BLA wars, Black Liberation Army wars. In the newspapers every day, every week, they were saying the Black Liberation Army was destroyed. And then a few weeks later, a couple of them would get gunned down in the street, and they'll say there was a few of them still running around. Once they captured a lot of comrades from the BLA and the Black Panther Party, and placed them in prison, they had to develop a new program because the brothers didn't stop struggling once they went to prison. When they went into prison, they started recruiting brothers and sisters in prison and sending them back out into the street. So what did they do? They developed a program called Price Act, Prison Activist Program. And it trained the correction department on how to deal with political prisoners. Price Act is still in place today under a different name. So I wanted you to understand that whenever the enemy sees a shift in our movement, they shift gears accordingly. And as the brother pointed out, they don't never rest. They change shifts on us. So I want to say to you that the support and the issue of political prisoners goes to the heart of our building our movement. Because if we don't free our political prisoners, if we are not committed to their freedom, then we may be tomorrow's political prisoners and have no support apparatus in place. So I got to end here. Ahmed's here with the hook, and so I hope we could have a good discussion, a fruitful discussion. Thank you.